Today is Monday, May 1st, 2017. This is Susan Resnick at San Diego State University about to record the oral history of Andreas Brown for Special Collections. This project is supported by a John and Jane Addams mini-grant for the humanities. Good morning, Andreas.
Good morning, Susan.
We are thrilled that you have come home to San Diego and to San Diego State University. You are an alumnus, graduating with honors in 1955 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in economics. You were a member of the National and Regional Champion Debating Team of the Honorary Speech Fraternity, Pi Kappa Delta, and also president of Sigma Chi Fraternity. After attending Stanford Law School, you served in the U.S. Army Staff Judge Advocate and returned to San Diego State for 3 years to teach speech and coach debate teams. As a lifelong bibliophile, you have promoted the appreciation and cultural significance of 20th century American literature and the arts throughout your adult life. You are nationally and internationally recognized as a prominent bookseller and literary estate consultant. You owned and operated the most important independent bookstore in the United States, the Gotham Book Mart, for 40 years, which you have described as sort of a literary club. When I asked you which of the myriad of roles you have played you value the most, you replied, mentor. From your teenage years on, you have mentored and nurtured others. Rather than continue to introduce you and to begin to describe you, I rather you tell your story. This interview will take the form of a conversational narrative. Let's begin at the beginning. Tell me about your early family coming to California. Where did they come from? Where did your family come from? What have you found out?
My family, to the best of our knowledge, landed in Boston in around 1631 or 32, and migrated down the eastern coast in Connecticut, and worked their way across to Kent, Connecticut, on the western border of the state. There were two young sons who would not inherit anything upon the death of their father. The older son would receive the entire estate. So the two younger ones, who were school teachers, decided to cross the state of New York by foot, and which was to the west. And when they reached the Ohio River, they constructed a flatbed boat, you would call it, I guess, because they were familiar with the rivers of Connecticut. And they went down to a promising area north of Cincinnati and settled in and started farming. The older of the two was injured in a farming accident, and he had to switch to the legal profession. So one of them was doing the farming and the other was handling business matters. And they eventually migrated over to Ohio, going west, as many people were doing, and they settled in Marshall County in a little town called Lincoln, Illinois, which was right on one of the major rivers there. The name escapes me. It happened to be in Abraham Lincoln's congressional district, and because the older brother among the Fenns, F-E-N-N, became acquainted with Lincoln and involved with his political aspirations, what he wanted to do. And there was correspondence in the Historical Society in Springfield, Illinois, that documents some of their communications and their relationship. The only son that evolved from these three brothers was sent to school in the East. He was very bright and managed to get into Yale University, where he was Phi Beta Kappa and in several distinguished honorariums. And then suddenly the family pulled him out of Yale in his second or third year and brought him back to Illinois. And from what we can speculate, they decided that they wanted to send him as far away from the pending Civil War as they possibly could, because he was the last male in the family line. So his father went out to California to investigate. He went to San Francisco and made some friends, and they found out that there was a very outstanding medical school in San Francisco called the Toland Medical School, or Medical College, and they sent the son out there, to, my great-grandfather, and enrolled him in the Toland School. He was the number one student in the second class to graduate from that school, which later became the University of California Medical School at San Francisco. And he remained after he graduated and became Dr. Toland's assistant. Dr. Toland was an expert in surgery, and my great-grandfather became a very skilled surgeon, which was a very rare thing to have anywhere west of the Mississippi. My great-grandfather after about 6 or 7 years, he got a little restless and he wanted to branch out on his own, and he heard that down in San Diego, a township was just beginning to be formed, and they would need doctors and lawyers and entrepreneurs and farmers, anybody they could get to come down there. So evidently he went down and looked it over, and he bought up about 20 or 30 acres below the, which is now the Balboa Park area, and he went down there and established a medical practice and helped to form the Medical Society in San Diego County. He was one of the charter members of the Medical Society in San Diego. And he was very concerned and interested in the development of the community. He had his own horse and buggy. He was just about the only doctor in San Diego that was willing to make house calls. And he managed to establish a lot of friendships. He was evidently a very generous and kind person. He ended up being the director of the county hospital. He held a lot of other prestigious positions in the city. He signed the later city charter that was published in the 1870s or 1880s. So he was a major figure, and he is really a kind of my inspiration in the genealogical tree of our family, because he was a very small man, but very devoted and very hardworking and greatly respected in the community. He died in, I think, 1907. His widow lived to about 1920. There's a lot of complicated history about that marriage, but I don't know if this is the appropriate time to get into all of that. But anyway, they had a daughter who they sent off to a finishing school in Oakland, California. It was a very prestigious school for children mostly from wealthy families, and I think just for women. And she graduated from that, and word has it through the family tree that she became a kind of self-important, oriented to wanting to be of a higher class than she really was. Her father was a doctor and her mother was a very bright lady, but she caused problems, and that's my grandmother,
right,
which would be my mother's mother,
I guess.
I'm bringing you down to my mother's mother.
Right.
And that story is I guess, an interesting one. According to the family rumors, my mother was one of four children, and they didn't anticipate having any more children, but at the age of 40, her mother became pregnant. And her mother was also a very small woman. They were like 5'2", and her husband was like 5'6". And her first baby was Ralph, and he was a 12-pound baby, and it almost killed her.
Oh.
But he was born and raised healthy. He later died in an automobile accident, so he was he was out of the family at a reasonably young age. But she had a very wealthy brother, Uncle Finn, we called him. He lived in Bel Air, above Los Angeles, and in a very famous movie star's home that he bought. And my aunt, much beloved Aunt Lois, was my mother's sister. She was about 18 when my mother was born. And there's many pictures in the family of showing my Aunt Lois holding my mother, appearing for all purposes to be the mother with her child. And my mother carried a kind of a grudge most of her life that her sister was always bossing her around and telling her what she should and shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. But obviously she was a mother figure.
Right.
And anyway, the story is, and it may be apocryphal, but the story is that my mother, when she was a teenager, she was rather rebellious because her parents were very religious. Oh. Very conservative, religious, church going 3 and 4 nights a week and so forth. She ran around with a gang of other teenage girls, and they decided they were all going to run away and go down to San Diego and live in Tent City at the El Coronado Hotel, because that's where the family traditionally went for vacations. The older people, you know, and they would stay at the hotel.
Right.
So these 3 or 4 girls, allegedly, went down to San Diego, and of course the reason was there were a lot of men there with all the military bases.
Oh, yeah.
And they were very excited to be on their own. They were teenage girls. And my mother evidently, because you have, I don't know, I'm going to assume this, you had the Army base there, you had the Navy base there, and you had the Marine base there. That's a lot of men.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. They're obviously, you know, drawn by that. My mother supposedly went to see a baseball game played by the Army baseball team against somebody else, and my father was on the baseball team.
Oh.
And she met him.
Oh, boy.
And they became very interested in each other. They were like 17 and 19 or 18 and 20. They were young. And they did get married, and they immediately had 3 children. My older brother by a year, myself, and then my sister by about a year and a half. So here is a 22-year-old woman married to a 23-year-old man with 3 children, and they're not the people they were when they met. My mother was very bright, very attractive, a rebellious person by tradition for the family. And my father was a party boy. I mean, he was a jock athlete in the Army, and he had a lot of pals who were wild and crazy crowd. And I think my father just decided he didn't want to be tied down, because the marriage just did not work.
They were young.
And that led to a lot of heartache.
Hard.
Here are 3 children with a mother who doesn't have a full education, although my mother read a lot, and my mother, something interesting about DNA here. My mother was a very skilled artist. And when we got into grammar school, my brother would be a year ahead of me, and then myself, and then my sister a year behind me. And we were all A1 artists.
Mm-hmm.
We all could draw and paint.
I think so.
And so there's something in the DNA. That doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
So we lived in a rather poor area of San Diego, eventually in the backcountry. Now, when I say the backcountry, I mean we lived on a kind of plateau in a cul-de-sac way at the end of the dead-end road, a very isolated area. And my sister and brother and I would sit in a giant pepper tree out in the backyard of the house. It was huge, and it extended out over the canyon. I mean, you were up high. My mother was not happy about it, but we really liked to sit in the tree. And as far as we could see, looking south and southeast, not a house, not a building, not a road or anything. And at night, there were no lights down there. So we were looking at Mexico before any of that land had been developed.
Oh my.
And in the springtime, we lived in the canyons. The canyons were our playground. And we knew how to get to our school by going through the canyons and shortcutting.
Where is this in San Diego?
San Diego. East San Diego.
East San Diego. Okay.
Yeah, south of south of University Avenue.
Okay.
The trolley car, the number 7 trolley car, ended at Fairmount, I think, and we had to walk to the house from there. It was quite a long walk. Anyway, in the springtime, that was the best, because the rains would fill up all the pools, and you could go swimming in the canyons, and you could catch polymorphs, which turned into frogs.
Fun.
And we lived in a very natural, uniquely natural environment as children, down in these canyons. And my mother would pack us lunches and send us on our way. And she didn't care how far we went, as long as we were home for dinner at 5 or 6. And my mother had a whistle, a natural whistle, not a machine whistle. And she could stand out on the end of the property and whistle, and we would hear that from maybe a half a mile away, and we knew we were late for dinner. That's how she got us to come.
And
that high school, that grammar school, by the way, I fell in love with my fourth grade teacher, Norma Brower. She was so beautiful, absolutely stunning. And I remember she had dark hair and beautiful face and nice figure. And you know, I'm a fourth grader, but I mean, I really hooked. And she said to me more than once, she said, "You know, you brown children, you're all such wonderful artists. Your brother was here last year, and he really was a very good artist. Are you a good artist?" And so I drew her some pictures, and she said, "Wow." And she said, "Your sister's one grade behind you. Is she an artist?" I said, "Yes, she's very good too. But my mother is the best artist." And her name was Norma Brower. And the thing I remember about Norma Brower was, in the morning, she looked wonderful. Mm-hmm. Her hair was nice, her makeup was great. She was just beautiful. By the end of the day, all her makeup was gone. Her hair was a mess. She looked exhausted because she was teaching.
Right.
But it was her attempt to try to be attractive. And I used to feel so sorry for her at the end of the day because she looked so tired. But I never forgot her.
That's wonderful. What school? This was your...
Hamilton Grammar School.
Okay.
It was way off in the boondocks. And we could go straight west and then straight south and then loop in to go to Hamilton. But if we went through the canyons, we could get there quicker.
When did you start liking reading and liking books?
Well, as soon as I could get my hands on books.
When you were young?
We had a tiny, tiny little branch library, the Carnegie Library in East San Diego. I mean, you could touch the four walls practically.
Mm-hmm.
But I joined the summer program, and you were allowed to check out 6 books or 8 books, and I took them all home and read them in a week and brought them back and took more. I was back and forth with books constantly. And one thing was, this library, like say this was the library, they cut it in half and there was a desk where the librarian sat, and those were the adult books, and these were what children could read. And I was always sneaking behind her or around her when she was busy because I wanted to read D.H. Lawrence or Henry Miller or somebody like that, and they didn't want me reading it.
Yeah.
So I was very aggressive. And I remember my parents were reading a novel by Aldous Huxley, and I don't remember the title now, but they both loved it. It was something they talked about a lot. So when they were done, I took it out into the pepper tree, and I climbed up there, and I read that entire book, and I can tell you honestly, I did not understand one single word. It was a very serious adult novel, very complex.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a Victorian novel with all these family brand. But, you know, that's the first time I realized that some books are not for children, you know. You have to pick and choose and you have to grow.
Yeah.
But I started collecting books probably in the 6th or 7th grade. And I would go into any used bookstore. I would go to the Salvation Army. And everywhere I went from I would say, Wilson to Hoover, I was dragging along 5 or 10 boxes of books.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't let go. My fraternity brothers, when I moved in the Sigma Chi fraternity house, they said, "What are all these boxes in your room?" I said, "They're books."
Right.
"You mean you carry 12 boxes of books everywhere you go?" I said, "Well, I don't have any place to put them."
I was going to say, when you were small and you first started doing this, where did you keep the books in your home? What'd you do?
Well, I'm sure I was a precocious reader. I mean, I always got A's in grammar school and junior high school. I had one teacher, Miss Minson, at Woodrow Wilson Junior High School, and she had a notorious reputation for being very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. She's where you learn to conjugate verbs. She's where you learn to construct a sentence with a subject and a predicate.
Yes.
And I want to give great credit to the educational system of San Diego now, that I didn't know it, but they filtered out the more promising students in the first year, and then they had an entire structure of specialized courses for us. The first place they put me was in an architectural drawing and wood cutting, making things out of wood, but architecture mostly. And I found I was fascinated by it, but I didn't let it distract me. Then they assigned me to a class for classical music. They didn't even, you're going to have to take a music course. So we went down to the room and sat down, and suddenly they're playing the Pyrgian Suite, and all of us kids, I mean, some of the kids probably came from families that do music, mm-hmm. but I didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. But I never forgot the Pyrgian Suite, because the teacher said, if you listen closely to the classical music, you can imagine a wonderful story. It may not be the story that the musician intended, but you can create one out of it. And the Pyrgian Suite is da 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 da. And it was a parade of people marching and playing flutes or whatever they were. And I never ever forgot that. And I said, "There's that could have something to do with my approach to decoding. I've never put this together until right now, that there was a meaning sometimes behind things, mm-hmm. and that music had a story very often, mm-hmm. and consequently, when I became curious about what Mr. Gordon was up to, that could have come from that music class. I've never thought about that.
That's why.
And then the next class they put us in, they just said, you're going to do these classes, was a math class with a no-nonsense teacher. But I caught on to math, other than when I got bored with math, very clearly. And what she did was, she had us go into the local community bank and get a checkbook. And we were taught how to write a check.
That's terrific.
And we had to create our own bank where we put the money in. And we, by the time we were out of that class, I had a savings account at Bank of America, which had about $12 in it. But I was so excited to have my own bank account.
That's wonderful.
It was wonderful. Well, this was an accelerated class for kids that were showing. And I took, I got up to, not trigonometry, but it was calculus. But one of them, I got so bored with higher math. I said, I will never, ever need this. I do not want this. And I'm not going to, I don't care if I can't get into San Diego State or Berkeley or wherever I want to go, but I'm not taking any more of these silly classes with mathematics. So I walked away from math. Science wasn't so bad. I'll never forget science, because it was one of the sports coaches that taught some of the minor sports, and I had gotten to know him just through being, because you know the coaches for the athletics are much more friendly with the students, informal.
Right.
And so he announced one day that a training teacher out of San Diego State is going to come in and give us a lecture on smoking. And in through the door came the most beautiful woman I have ever seen in my life. And later I found out all about her. Her brother happened to be a Sigma Chi, so that tied in. But her name was Rose something. And what she did was just astonishing. She gave us a film to look at, a short one about the horrors of smoking. And then she brought into the room a pair of lugs, sheep's lugs, the actual raw lugs. Oh. And they were hanging on hooks. And everybody was just, it was disgusting. And she very quietly, this delicate, pretty girl, she's probably a junior, senior in the education program at San Diego State, and she probably got credits for doing this. And she proceeded to slice open these lungs. But before she did that, one lung stayed over here. The other one she pumped cigarette smoke into. And when she cut that one open, all of the inner tissue was black. Boy, did she make her point. I never intended to smoke. My parents had smoked around me, and I just was horrified. But that made it for sure. I will never forget that experience of those two lugs hanging there. And this pretty young lady, it didn't bother her at all. But people were moaning and groaning and turning away in the class. It was a hoot.
It's memorable, clearly.
And then the great experience I had, well, first of all, I back up. It was traditional at Hamilton Grammar School that when you graduated, that you got an autograph book and you got all your classmates to sign it.
Yes.
But I decided I wanted Miss Cross, who was the principal, to sign mine. And Miss Cross was another small woman, very compact, and no nonsense, but friendly. And I asked her if she would. She said, of course, Andreas, I'll be glad to sign your book. And what she wrote in it was, in order to have friends, you must be a friend. And I have never, ever forgotten that.
Well, by the way,
but I was a grammar school kid.
But that's
wonderful, isn't it?
These things really stay with you. And as you and I were talking, not only, I said to you, this to you a couple of days ago, that it emerged that you clearly have been a mentor throughout your life, but you've also been a friend.
I had a lot of friends in grammar school. I had no problem with that. I picked and chose, but I've never forgotten what it said.
Yeah.
In order to have friends, you must
be a friend.
You must reach out to people.
And that was good. And you have.
And she probably wrote that in every kid's book, but it certainly stuck with me. Now what was I going to tell you about something else? Junior high school.
Well, let's think about, I just wanted to mention
something. Oh, I got to tell you this because it's
ahead.
Important. I was assigned a counselor. Every student had a counselor in high school.
Okay.
Mine was Miss Inkebritzen. And she was about 5'2". And we had taken a lot of tests in junior high school and high school, so she knew that I was going to be an A student unless I fooled around. And she called me in her office one day. In those days, you got 6 grades every semester. The 6th grade was for penmanship.
Oh, yes.
How dare they do that to a left-handed person?
Oh,
where
guess what?
Every single desk is cut this way so the right-handers can... And our arms are all hanging out in the air. And it was in my senior year they put in one row of left-handed desks. My senior year. And that was in the class where all the debaters were and the really smart, smart students were. And we complained so much about it because there were a lot of left-handers was in my group. But I remember Miss Ingebrigtsen came to me and said, Andreas, you are going to take the typing class. When you get to college and law school and the world, your handwriting is never going to be good. So you're going to take typing. I said, I'm not going to take typing. Yes, you are. Why won't you? I said, that's where all the girls are going. They want to be secretaries. I'm not going in there with 25 girls and taking a typing. I mean, I knew that I would be ridiculed for doing it.
Mm.
And she said, I am not budging. She said, I'll tell you what you do. You get to class a little early and you sit in the front row and they're all behind you. You don't even see them. She was a smart lady.
Oh, that was smart.
Well, when I finished that class, I could type 103 words a minute without an error.
It worked.
I mean, sometimes an error, but that was my high score. So when I got to state and I was taking lots of heavy loads of classes with papers, I was I'm knocking them off with no trouble at all. When I got to Fort Ord, when I went into the Army for 8 weeks of basic training, they wanted to know, can you repair a car? Can you cook food? Can you manicure lawns and flower beds? What can you do? And then they would take you and put you in that department. You're repairing the trucks or you're in the kitchen cooking.
Right.
So on my test, I made 103 words a minute. So they called me in immediately and they said, Mr. Brown, we're in great need of clerical help right now. We have a young man who was a master sergeant in Korea, and his commanding officer was killed in the field, and we had to take him and make him a second lieutenant because we didn't have enough manpower. But he doesn't write a very good letter. So we're going to put you in his office. And this was, it used to be a one-bedroom, living room, kitchen kind of a setup, but they converted it into a legal office, or a military office. So I can't remember his last name, but when he knew I could type and do business, sort things out and everything, it gave me a lot of grunt work. But when he got ready to write a letter to his CO, the next guy up, he wasn't very secure about it. So he called me in and he said, Private Brown, would you look at what I've written here and see if you can maybe make some improvements in it? So what I did was I typed it up exactly the way he did it, which was terrible, and then I wrote the revised edition. And he looked at the two and he said, oh, this is much better, do this one. From that day on, I edited all of his mail, including his weekend passes. And he called me in one day. Now, they didn't like to have college kids who were coming into the Army mixed with the kids who were dropping out of high school. We could cause trouble. Yeah. They figured that we would turn everybody against them or something. So they took the college people and they mixed us in with, we had some Indian students that came from the Aleutian Islands out in Alaska. Mm-hmm. We had a mixture of people. But I had about 8 or 9 friends from Stanford who were in the same class with me. So when he spread out the 3-day passes, he didn't look at them, he just signed them. So I made out 3-day passes for all my friends, and we left 3 days every time we had a chance, 8-day weekends. Then we were moved over to the officers' quarters, where we had converted a place into a legal office. And that's where the colonel, who was the head of staff judge advocate for the Western United States, like the chief justice of a court, or appellate court anyway, for the Army. And we had 2 secretaries who sat out in the living room. The colonel had a large, would have been the bedroom, and I had like a small room, I don't know what it was at one time, but I was his clerk. And we got along very well and had very, very interesting cases. I won't go into all that, but I made really unusual legal cases. A peeping Tom, a general who was accused of undue influence. When they had court martials, he would bring all of the court martial people into the auditorium, the potential be picked for the court martial, and he would give a rant and a rave about, I'm sick and tired of people getting away with all these things. I want convictions and I want them now. So when you people get picked for these courts, I want convictions.
Yeah.
Well, that's undue influence. That's illegal.
Yeah.
So the defense attorneys on the campus, they brought in their secretaries to sit in the back row and take down everything he said, and he got kicked out and sent to Korea. Whoa. I mean, it was juicy stuff. But it wasn't a boring experience.
No, it sounds interesting.
And it almost convinced me to go back to law school before.
I was wondering. Well, can we backtrack a little to high school?
Sure.
Let's
Absolutely.
Go back to high school, because you clearly, from the yearbook that we've been looking at, you had lots of friends and you were very involved. And talk a little bit about high school.
Well, I had a big problem. My brother was not a very good student, so he came in there and he was fooling around and getting poor grades and stuff, and a lot of people ridiculed him, and that was hard for me to take, but there wasn't much I could do about it.
Yeah.
My brother just was lazy and didn't want to study.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had my sister. And the separation and the divorce between my father and my mother took a terrible toll on her. Terrible.
Yeah.
And she lost all self-confidence. Here she goes from this scrawny, she's 5'8 or something, and freckles and strawberry blonde, reddish hair, and she was like an unattractive girl growing up.
Yeah.
But snap your finger and wow, she just, within 6 months to a year. And I think what it did was it caused some jealousy on my mother's part.
Oh.
She saw how attractive my sister was, and that a lot of men were interested in her.
Oh.
And boy, she's going to get all the breaks. And look at me, I'm stuck with 3 kids. There are some things I don't want to talk about.
That's okay.
What do you mean it's okay?
Yeah, no, I mean, just don't talk about it then.
But can we take things out later?
Yes.
Okay, then I will tell you a story.
Except that if it's something that you think you don't want to talk about, I can put it on pause.
Okay.
Let's do that. Just one moment. We're going to pause. Oh, wow. Let's record this, because this is, you know, here. So continue telling me about jobs that you did.
Right. Well, it started off in a very simple way. On hot summer days, my brother and sister and I, we didn't even have enough to buy a 5-cent root beer float. So we would ring doorbells until we could collect enough pop bottles and cash them in so that we could go and get something. That then expanded into my wanting to make more money to maybe buy a pair of shoes or some clothes I needed or whatever it was. So I started volunteering to mow people's lawns and clip their hedges and plant their flower beds and stuff. And because I was a good gardener, I made steady customers. and that was very helpful to me financially. For just nickels and dimes, you know, in those days everything was, you could go to a movie for 15 cents or 10 cents.
So is this the 1940s? I'm trying to picture when you were in junior high school.
I should have brought my chart. I have a chart.
I can figure it out because you were born in 1930.
Well, let me back up a minute.
Yeah.
I think I remember Coronado. I should have talked about Coronado.
Well, you can.
Here are three little kids living on the island of Coronado, which had a lot of retired military people there, but we had a little house. And my mother liked to pack us a brown paper bag lunch. This is during times when we weren't in school, summertime, and send us on our way. Parents obviously felt secure about children. I look back on it now, and we were allowed to roam all over the place.
It was different.
I think it was because two older boys and a younger sister, my mother felt, in the meantime, she's working hard at home trying to get the house out of it. And when we left Coronado, well, first of all, in Coronado, our favorite thing was to take our brown paper bag lunches and sneak on the boats. They went back and forth to get to the island. And it was a car boat. They loaded all the cars on and drove off, and then the other ones drove off. And we would hide behind the cars and play hide and go seek. And I remember we would take the crust off of our sandwiches and feed it to what I want to say are dolphins or something. I don't know what they were, but whatever they were swimming in the Coronado San Diego waterway there.
Yeah.
And we loved to feed them. That was a big thing with us. But eventually we got caught every time, and then they kicked us off and we'd go play somewhere else. But we did a lot of that sneaking on. But the two stories that I remember in my earliest childhood, and this is a tricky thing because if you have an amusing event or an unusual event, it gets talked about, and then you think you remember it.
Yeah.
So I don't swear that I remember this firsthand.
Okay.
But these are two stories that are very clear in my mind.
Okay.
We knew our mother and father liked to read the Sunday paper. That was ritual.
Right.
I'm sure black coffee and cigarettes were too. But they would read the paper in bed.
Right.
So my brother and I decided one day to go and get them the newspapers. Now, we're really little, probably 3 and 4 or 4 and 5 or something. And my brother was running the show. So we got our wagon out, and we went down to the place that sold the newspapers. It was a block and a half away. And the newspapers and magazines were all out on racks in front of the store. So we loaded up our wagon with every newspaper and magazine on the stand and took it home to our parents. So when they woke up, and we said, we have a surprise for you, Mommy and Daddy. And they said, well, we went and got your papers and magazines for you. What are you talking about? Well, look here. And they looked out the window and says, oh, my God. Where did they come from? Well, we went down to the store and got them. Well, you turn right around and take them back. And, of course, they were trying not to laugh. And I'm sure the guy at the Megan, maybe he didn't even know, because if she said it's right back immediately. But it was a very funny story that got passed around, how enterprising we were. The other one was, and this I don't remember at all, so it hadn't been told to me. My brother found, now again, 3 and 4 or 4 and 5, and we're on our own a lot. People didn't. We got to go out and play a lot. My mother wanted us out from under, you know.
Yeah.
He found a can of green car paint.
Yeah.
And he painted me.
Oh.
And took me into the house to show me to what he had done. And my mother knew that it was dangerous because that paint solidifies and you could suffocate.
Oh, God.
So my mother was horrified, and they got something to clean it off of me. Evidently, I lived anyway.
Oh.
But that was the other story that got told over the dinner tables more than once.
Yeah.
That my brother painted me with green automobile paint.
Oh.
And he thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
But I do remember the boat and the feeding the animals. But Coronado was very limited because we moved, and I wonder if you know about this. Have you ever heard of the Brick Row in National City? It's a famous architectural building.
You know it?
It runs a whole block, and it's copied from old New England and Great Britain. It's a connection of apartments that are two stories high, and it's an entire block. And now it's turned out to be one of the great architectural phenomena in California. I mean, it's famous. Well, it wasn't when we lived there. We lived in the last one at the end, but it had a backyard. So I know we had a backyard to play in, and we were, this is really a sad story. We were right across the street. I remember Pearl Harbor because we were sitting in front of the radio. We had a standing radio, and it had a big screen, and I was sitting on the floor listening, and so was my brother, and they interrupted to announce the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
And you remember that?
Oh, I do remember that. It was so shocking. Well, everybody was just,
well, you
can imagine. Yeah. And my mother had a favorite slogan. Every time there was, my mother had a sense of humor, sometimes. Every time there was a loud explosion, you know, like a crash or a bang or, you know, where it came from. My mother said, the Japs are taking the harbor. She would just shout that out anytime. The Japs are taking the harbor, I guess. It was a joke, but I mean, it was a...
Well, you were 8 years old then.
No.
No?
Because I went to the first and second grade in National City.
Oh. Okay.
So I would have been 5 or 6, depending upon, you know, what the school rules were at the time.
Okay.
And I remember we took our lunches in a brown paper bag, and we walked, my sister, my brother, and I. And the further we got to the school, the more people were walking with us. It would pick up.
Oh, yeah.
And I, to me, we were a mile away, but we're probably 3 blocks away.
Yeah.
Because I don't remember. What else was there about that? Oh, we were 1 block away from the movie theater in National City. So we would always save our nickels because for 10 or 15 cents, we could see 2 full features, a sports film, a report film, and a cartoon. And my mother loved it because we were gone for 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah.
And we bought popcorn for a nickel and maybe a Hershey bar for another nickel. But that was the big event to go to the movies. We loved it. And I sat through more very complicated adult films, not understanding anything. And if the film was scary, my little sister, she wasn't so little, but she would go under her chair, she was terrified, and I'd have to coach her out and say, it's only a movie, Lois. Come on now. My nickname for her obviously came from the word sister. My nickname for her was Susu, because that sounds like sister to a 2 or 3 year old. Be nice to your sister, and so on. And I was very protective of her because she was so vulnerable and shy. Great sadness in the story.
Well, some of the, but you got pleasure out of books too. You got pleasure out of reading, right?
Well, I want to tell you the sad story.
Okay.
Right across the street from the brick row, which was going into countryside, it wasn't developed, was a giant vegetable and fruit garden, 5 or 10 acres, owned by a Japanese family that had about 3 or 4 children. And within a week, we got up and went out, and there were no children.
Right.
There was no family.
Right.
They came and took them all away. And my mother had a terrible trying to tell us. Well, I said, well, what are they doing with them? And she said, well, they're protecting them. They're putting them in a safer place.
Oh.
She tried to calm us down.
Yeah.
But these were kids that we really played with every day.
That's terrible.
And to see their house dark and nobody taking care of the land anymore, the vegetables were all kind of, that was a blow. I didn't realize at the time the historical significance of it. But when I later saw the documentaries on these horrible internment camps they put them in, I realized what had happened.
Yeah, well, there is, you know, the relevancy of the historical context to your experience as a child. I mean, it you always remember these
things. Okay, and also, instead of putting us in the children's home, because my mother might have had some complaints from my sister and brother and me that we didn't like it very much, and isn't there anything else we can do? So she went to the city, and she found a church-going family, which made her comfortable because she had a church background, although she rebelled, in La Jolla. And it was a block and a half from the beach, and we could walk to the school, and it just looked ideal. And my brother, sister, and I could stay together in this family.
Mm-hmm.
They had a big two-story house, and they had a couple of children, but it turned out not to be so good. We could walk to school, by the way. And I remember many, many times we would go down if it was warm enough, and we would walk along the beach all the way to the school and then back up, so that we never walked in the neighborhood. We walked on the beach as much as we could because we loved being near the beach.
Right.
I mean, that was a joy. But then we had a problem. The family turned out to be holy rollers.
Oh my goodness.
They spoke in tongues. I mean, but do you know anything about this?
Little.
This is the most extreme people who interpret the Bible literally.
Right, fundamentalists.
And they're fundamentalists. And my mother didn't know it.
Oh.
And first of all, my brother and sister and I started laughing.
Oh.
Because they would start preaching and then they'd start wailing and gibbering and crying and actually get down on the floor.
Oh.
And finally we were told that it's not supposed to be funny, it's supposed to be serious. So I managed to get a hold of my mother. Somehow I must have written her a letter in care of my
and
uncle,
told her?
And said, "Mother, do you know what you put us into?" Well, she came down in a flash.
Oh, good.
She came down and yanked us out of there. But we were there for quite a while, at least a year, because I went to school in La Jolla.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that because it had a typical Spanish garden built inside of the school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a grammar school.
Mm-hmm.
But in that garden, inside of the school, was a garden of cactus plants.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fooling around one day, probably before class started, and I backed into one of the cactus plants. And I had, my whole rear end was filled with these horrible thorns. And they had to take me in the nurse's office and down with my pants and get pliers and pull these things out. That's something you remember.
Oh, yes.
But that's the most distinctive thing I remember about my school in La Jolla. And if it hadn't happened, I might not remember the school at all. Except I remember walking along the beach to go to it.
It's beautiful.
But you could see where Children's Home at least twice, Holy Rollers, mother disappearing into L.A. two or three times. No wonder my sister felt insecure.
Right.
You know, and where was our father? God only knows.
Yeah.
He was a notorious card player. He was a notorious partier. He was a notorious womanizer. So he was just like very irresponsible. Once in a while, he would show up in like in a brand new fancy car with all kinds of presents in the back seat.
Oh.
Because he'd won the horses. He'd won probably, you know, $20,000 or something. So he thought, I'll go home and visit the kids and Helene, my mother's name was Helene, and stick around for a while and see if I like it. And of course, the minute they had a fight about something, he was gone.
Yeah. What was your mom's name? Your mother's
Helene
name?
Celeste Kimball.
I see. And your father's name?
Harvey Brown.
Okay.
He had the most wonderful mother in the world. She realized what he was doing, abandoning his children and his wife. So she came to my mother and she said, I will come and live with you and I will get a job. She was elderly, she was probably 50. And she said, I'll get a job downtown somewhere. I can take the number seven trolley car and go to work every morning and I'll bring the money home to you. So we gave her the front bedroom, I remember, in the Woodrow Wilson Hoover house. And she had that room. And we adored her.
Oh,
we
nice.
Just, she was just very special.
That's such a good thing.
And she liked to play solitaire. And she read her Bible every night. And she was very affectionate to us.
That's so nice.
So we got something we didn't even get from our mother.
Well, it's wonderful.
My mother was a very cool, detached lady, and very bitter, very bitter. I mean, I think she, and sometimes almost looked at us like, a chain around her neck, because she had three kids and she tried to feed us. Are we recording now?
Yes, but
I'll turn it off again because I've got another story to tell you.
Okay, one second. We are going to turn it off.
But I want you.